Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. My name is Alison Van Diggelen. I'm host of Fresh Dialogues and a BBC radio contributor. It's my pleasure to introduce Steve Jurvetson, partner at venture capitalist firm DFJ. Steve serves on the boards of SpaceX, Synthetic Genomics, and Tesla Motors, and was founding VC investor in Hotmail, Interwoven, Canna, and NeoPhotonics. He also led the investments in other companies that were acquired for a total of $12 billion. Previously, Steve was an R&D engineer at Hewlett-Packard, consultant at Bain & Company, and also worked in product marketing at Apple and Next Software. At Stanford University, Steve finished his undergrad degree in 2.5 years and graduated number one in his class as the Henry Ford Scholar. He holds an MS in electrical engineering from Stanford and received his MBA from the Stanford Business School. Steve has received numerous awards, including Young Global Leader by the World Economic Forum and Deloitte's Venture Capitalist of the Year for 2012. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Steve Jurvetson.
Thanks, Alison.
Thank you for joining us, Steve. So I'd like to start with the big picture, Steve. You are in a unique position to talk about the future of Silicon Valley, the future of innovation and tech. Can you paint us a big picture of the next 10 years, the next 20 years, and even the next 50 years?
Sure. Actually, I think the next 50 years is the easiest of those three, and 10 years is the hardest, maybe because I'll be around and people can tell me how wrong I was in 10 years, but 50, they'll have forgotten. But joking aside, I actually find the framework of looking far enough in the future that trajectories you believe to be inevitable will have played out, and it makes it a much easier forecasting modality to start with certainties like, look enough far enough in the future, all vehicles will be electric, the way Elon knows to be true. We'll have a Mars colony probably within 50 years. We will, in the next 50 years, have to grow more food than since the beginning of agriculture. That will be largely driven by GMOs and a variety of roboticized forms of farming and moving off meat production in the way we think of it, killing animals to get meat. We will grow meat in different ways within 50 years. And that actually has some pretty profound effects on everything from greenhouse gases to everything. As I think about all the companies we're involved with and the entrepreneurs like Elon Musk that are changing the world, in that 50-year horizon, the world is going to look remarkably different than today. I think future shock is a perpetually occurring phenomenon, and it's going to happen in ways you can't imagine. We'll have mastered the reengineering of life, microbes to start to make fuels, chemicals, vaccines, drugs, nutraceuticals, food. We'll be moving on to plants and animals. There are efforts underway to humanize pigs so you can transplant their organs instead of from other humans, which are scarce. Those projects are already well underway. And so within 10 years to 20 years, those will be bending our minds, the advances in biology. And in the sort of 20 to 50 year time frame, I think things that feel more like AI will start to play out along that trajectory, where we master the design of these complex systems. I think underlining much of everything going on in the future of engineering over the next 20 years, and certainly up to 50, will be a move away from traditional engineering to techniques that feel more like parenting, where there's deep learning, machine learning, evolutionary algorithms, any kind of iterative algorithm. It'll feel like something a little out of control, but it'll allow us to create things that are beyond that that we can understand, to create things that exceed human understanding. So it's a brave new world in terms of capabilities, processes, advances. I mean, being a multiplanetary species, having a colony on Mars and probably the moon is one of those greatest hits, I think, in human evolution. I mean, up there with the opposable thumb, you know, the neuron and multicellular beings, that's a big step to say we've actually hedged our bets and are present more than one planet. So, I mean, maybe I'll end there and say the 50 years is where I focus and then chain back to the present and say, okay, if that's true, what might we want to look at today that's going to be interesting in the next 10 years? So an eye out for the precursors for synthetic meat, if that's the ultimate, or how can we do investments in electric vehicles knowing that that's going to take a long time to switch over, and the infrastructure and the chicken and egg problem of where do you refuel and how do you make it convenient? Those kind of questions make it very difficult to do business forecasting in the 10-year horizon, and frankly, even tougher in the 2 and 3-year horizon. Because the future vision could be off by, you know, 5 to 10 years in terms of its takeoff, and then you lose all your money or you lose your business or your startup. So timing is really tough in the 10-year horizon. I think along some of these trajectories, for example, in electric vehicles, for example, is probably the toughest to forecast. But I would think that in 10 years, no one debates that it's inevitable.
Great picture. Mm-hmm. Steve, you've described yourself as a raging techno-optimist. Can you talk about particular sectors? In fact, what future trends are you most excited about?
Well, just raging, maybe be more opportunity. It's kind of like that. And one of the reasons I think I use that term, by the way, was to remind people that is the case. And almost everything I see and do, the entrepreneurs we meet are incredible people, and they paint and forge the future. And it's almost always for the better. And it's sort of something we take for granted. The technology is synonymous with progress, and progress actually has an exponential vector up and to the right. Most of human history, that wasn't something people believed or even understood or had a sight of, because it was across many generations that such progress was noticed. Now it occurs within years. So that's the optimism. But the reason I think I use those words was to caveat that I'm really worried about a accelerating rich-poor gap coming from technology. So that's sort of the one thing that worries me, and that's why I may have used language that strong. Or maybe someone else called me that. I don't know.
That was a self-description.
Self-description, yeah, right. So I think it was to offset that I'm really worried about this other thing, but okay. I'm normally not a pessimist.
That's something I'd like to get to. But what I'd like to do is go through various sectors, because we have a lot of audience members here. I'm sure there are a lot of entrepreneurs in the audience, and I'd like to tackle each sector. So let's start with AI, artificial intelligence and robots. You're an investor in Rethink Robots. Mm-hmm. What's new with them? What's coming down the road for them?
Sure. So they have a new robot called Sawyer that they're talking about a bit, which is a kind of like the Roadster for Tesla, and then the Model S is, you know, the refined and polished version. The Roadster proves the concept. The sedan is what people really want. So similarly, with Rethink, there's a proof point that a robot can be made that, for those who don't know what this is like, it's my, you know, child at 8 years old can program it without looking at a manual. You basically take it out of the box, plug it in the wall, and you program it by moving the arms. So if you want it to pick up a cup and move it across the table, you just grab the arm, move it over, put the little pinchers on the cup, lift it to the other place, and then it just does that task. And then they're layering, just like Tesla upgrades with software over time, this piece of hardware keeps getting upgraded. Its cameras can now start to recognize cups that are moving and generalize from the example you gave to perhaps slightly more complex situations that it might entail. But at no point are you at a keyboard, at no point are you programming in some robotic programming language. So it's a completely different metaphor, kind of like the Apple II moment in robotics, where the price point's about the same in current dollars, the ease of use is radically different. It's something I bought on a whim, without a particular purpose in mind, which kind of was like the Apple II in the early days. Why? Who knows what we're going to use it for, but it's fun to play with. In the industrial setting, though, there's a lot of things you can do with it, and they are. They're being used in a variety of batch mode production environments and places where you pick and place stuff. So there's a generalizing from that company and others like it. There's a second wave of industrial robotics going on, where it seemed to be an industry that was stuck for a long time with a similar price points, expensive. Robots were dangerous, didn't work in or among people, and they were sequestered mainly for automotive applications as the primary use. And now there's all kinds of places where they're working among people, unskilled laborers are programming them, humans are working near them, they're safe because they don't do anything faster or more aggressively than a human would, and that's where they can be a drop replacement for any sedentary human doing a mindless task, which hopefully in the future we won't be doing. So generalizing from that, the consumer or home-facing robots are one of the big next questions. And so over the next maybe 10 years, that is going to become increasingly compelling, where they need, in that case, to be in motion, and that adds complexity. But if you think about a Roomba on steroids with maybe an arm to just pick up after you. It could be any number of things. And again, if you think of that parenting metaphor, it's not going to be perfect, but if you treat it like a pet and you think it's going to make mistakes, you will engage consumers to train these things, and that's how they learn. So again, the process of programming them is the same process as parenting. A lot of it happens at the factory, but a lot of it continues at deployment, and they get better and better over time. So I think robotics will make that trajectory, and AI is harder to predict, because there's a reasonable point of view that, you know, we just might not get there anytime soon. And I certainly don't think we're just going to, you know, engineer an AI, like, just out of whole cloth. Like why? Certainly not AI that's greater than ourselves. Like, what confidence would we have that that's doable? But if you said, could you evolve one? Well, how could you not? I mean, that would be, like, the worst bet in the world if you put no time frame on it, but said, could you evolve something smarter than yourself? Say, that's the entire history of humanity. Like, our greatest grandchildren, 42 generations from now, are going to be smarter than us. Like, we don't even have to engineer that.
So you're saying that's inevitable.
It's inevitable. Then the question is, can we pull it in? Can we use that same leap of faith that says, and we know it's doable, to do it in some other substrate and to do it faster than biological evolution would allow.
Right. And talking about mm-hmm. robots and specifically Tesla, mm-hmm. Elon Musk was in town last week and said autonomous driving, that's something that Tesla is going to be a leader in. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that focus? Do you feel Tesla should be focused on that particular aspect?
Well, that's a baiting question. Do I disagree with Chairman Elon? No, joking aside, I'm clearly not going to answer that as worded, but I know where you're getting at, which is I'll give you my personal point of view, but not anchor it to Tesla, because I'm on the board of Tesla. It's a public company. I'm not about to answer that, but nice try. Here's what I can say. It's really important and really exciting what you can do with autonomous driving. Something that may not be as widely known is it has to be deployed on an electric vehicle, more or less. You could go to great efforts to bolt an autonomous driving system onto a gas-burning car, but it's just such a pathetic waste of time. And the ones you see that look like gas burners are the hybrids. Very few vehicles are instrumented in a way. We have a fully drive-by-wire steering, braking, everything. Because when you have a gas engine, it's so tempting to use that for some parts of it. So my point was just autonomous driving maps elegantly to electric vehicles. Those you really would like to have an EV to do autonomous driving. Autonomous driving, we haven't begun to see the potential of this. So you see the Google videos, you see some of the promo pieces, but even the future of urban planning and design could change when you don't have to have parking. When you have driving as a service, which both Google and some other companies not yet announced are going to approach the market. You don't
like
sell
Uber?
People cars. Uber will do this mm-hmm. for sure. The Uber service, imagine it will be roboticized. And by the way, about 20% of people on Earth today that have a job drive as their form of employment. That's all going to go away. No question. It's kind of scary. A lot of people don't get paid. Subsistence farmers is not really a job. They're just growing food for themselves. So you have to take that part out when you look at the percent of people who get paid to do something. But it's so much better. You get rid of global gridlock, which you would otherwise have. You can pack cars in much more densely. In urban environments, people spend sometimes up to 40% of their time looking for parking. It is astounding how inefficient it is. And when they're roboticized small vehicles, they're actually more efficient than mass transit for almost all cases. There's only a few corner cases in Japan where the trains are better than the autonomous fleet of cars could be, simply because most trains are empty half the time during commute hour, same in the Bay Area. You look at BART going counter commute. It's like empty. Very inefficient. Autonomous vehicles allow, of course, for safety. They allow for a much better resource utilization. And, of course, car driving services can proliferate because you'll have perfect data on where everything is. Right.
Right. And talk about the third generation of Tesla. Mm-hmm. Have you seen a prototype? Have you driven on a prototype? Can you give us an idea of what we should expect?
It's bigger than a bread box, yes. No, I'm not going to answer that one either, but another nice try. She's referring to the vehicle that, I think Tesla blogged a master plan before they even shipped a car.
Top secret master plan.
And this is still the plan, which is the affordable, more mass market car is, they call it Gen 3 or this next vehicle. No, so the Model X is the story for this year. That is something that I have been in, and that is
That's the
SUV mm-hmm. with the Falcon Wing doors that lift up and out of the way.
And we'll see that later this year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when might we see the third generation, the mass market car?
Whenever Tesla said it would, yeah. I'll do the indirect pointer, whatever they said. No, I'm not going to add to it. No, I couldn't. I shouldn't.
Okay. Right. And is there a prototype? You don't have to describe it, but is there one?
In someone's mind, I'm sure.
Okay. we talked earlier, the Twitter sphere, the mm-hmm. blogosphere is a buzz about Tesla was almost sold to Google in 2013. Mm. Can you make any comment on that?
Well, I know Ashley has that in his new book. I just received a preprint today. And the reason I can't is I noticed about Tesla and Google said no comment. So I haven't had a chance to check with them, so I shouldn't. I can tell you, Tesla almost died in 2008, and that story I know very well and was there for that and participated actively. Google and Tesla, and more specifically Elon and Larry, have a long friendship. I mean, they've known each other for over a decade, and they've worked together on quite a few things. And Google, as most people know, invested just under $1 billion in SpaceX recently to collaborate on satellites and a variety of other things. And so they share a lot of interest. Here's an interesting anecdote that I personally experienced firsthand. I was having lunch with Larry Page, and he was talking about corporate governance and the desire to do good while still being at a company. And he was, in a very poignant way, saying, if I got hit by a bus today, what should I do with all mine? And he actually tried to remember how many billions he had, which was adorable that he didn't quite remember how much it was. And he goes, I should leave it all to Elon Musk. right? Mm-hmm. I should leave it all to him. And I was like, what? He meant SpaceX. And his point was he believes in that mission strongly and thought it would do more good than most philanthropic efforts he knew, even though it was a private corporation. And he was actually a bit almost jealous that Elon could say things like, we won't go public until we have thousands of people on Mars, not just, you know, landed on Mars, not just humans on Mars, but like sustainable colonies. Public companies can't usually talk like that. That's the kind of chatter that doesn't tend to survive quarterly results.
Yeah. But it was Larry Page's comment specifically about the Tesla.
SpaceX.
But nothing to do with Tesla.
He didn't mention it specifically.
Right.
He said Elon Musk, and then he clarified SpaceX.
I see.
And his point was, here's a guy that's changing the world in bold and important ways. And there's a lot of things Google is doing that are similar vectors. They're working on very similar things now. I think it's inspiring.
Okay. And Tesla has a big announcement next week about batteries. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, I'm not going to ask you to preempt Elon Musk's announcement. However, give us the case for batteries. I mean, for some people, it's a different market. Why is Tesla going into battery storage, not just battery storage for the home, but for the utility scale?
That's right, grid scale, right. It's an interesting question, and this may be the first peek into a unified theme across companies. So as people know, Elon Musk is an incredibly prolific entrepreneur, having, in a sense, come up with or been at the founding team of, you know, Tesla, SolarCity, which his cousins run, that he conceived on a drive to Burning Man, SpaceX, before that PayPal, all different industries at first that seemed to have nothing to do with each other. But now the troika of perhaps SolarCity and the Gigafactory, which isn't really a company, but it's an incredible initiative underway in Nevada right now. And Tesla comes into light for the first time to say, well, there perhaps is a synergy. This view, let's say 20 years out, of a distributed utility, where SolarCity has the solar cell installation and leasing and basically ownership and installation and the whole shebang, and now actually building panels as well for solar on homes everywhere. Well, once you get enough of that, and they're somewhere around, last I checked, 40% market share in the United States, you start to generate so much energy that you are like a variety of utilities combined, but it's ephemeral, right? If you're not using that energy when generated, it goes away. And so you right now push it to the grid, and it's expected the utilities can make use of this, especially since solar is generated during peak hours. But what if you wanted to get rid of the grid altogether? What if you wanted to, in fact, envision a future where this was entirely solar? You would need ideally distributed storage as well. You could do it centrally, but there's arguments for transmission line losses that, you know, if every solar cell came with a big battery that could, you know, smooth out your daily needs, you could just disconnect from the grid. It might be still good to have the grid for a variety of smoothing functions, but you could certainly lower the generation capacity currently that pushes on fossil fuels and nuclear. So the idea here is, well, how to pull that off? And people, when they thought of the Tesla, like as a customer of Tesla and SolarCity, I see the solar cells, I see the car. I'm like, can't we just connect these together? Where if I need to suck energy out of my car, I can, and if you know, I can use it to buffer the load from my cells. But that's not so easy.
Do you have one? Do you have a Tesla?
I don't have the stationary storage thing. No, but that would be that solution, as well as for people who don't even have the car, it'd just be the solar and the storage. And so the idea is, you need some form of storage. There have been arguments of what the best form would be, especially in the home. And part of the synergy and leverage that's, I guess, obvious for Tesla is when you're going to build an enormous plant of batteries, anticipating the third generation vehicle that we talked about, you're going to have some excess capacity potentially for some period of time as you ramp up. There'd be blocks when you produce a lot more batteries than you might need in that particular month. Well, what are other interesting things you could do with them? And it also relates to, what would you do at the end of life of a car? Those battery packs may not be as good as they were at the beginning, but they're really useful for a variety of secondary storage uses potentially later. So realize, again, for folks who don't know, this Gigafactory isn't named that just out of hubris. It would be the largest factory in the world by footprint. And they're eventually going to build many of them. And it would, that one factory alone at that scale would exceed global capacity today. So, I mean, this is just unfathomable amount of batteries. And what I really have to credit Elon for is realizing that these numbers pencil out to be so enormous, and to share that with the world before he had the solution in the bag.
And talk about the utility scale side. If you were a utility, if you were in charge of PG&E today, talk about how...
Right.
how you'd be feeling and what you might be doing with this.
Right. So on one hand, you're threatened by solar, and you're going to do all your dastardly deeds to, you know, try to quench and kill innovation, because that's what big companies do. It's in their blood. That's what they're expected to do. But on the other hand, they need this too, because whenever, whether by mandate or goodness of their heart, so mandate, they do more solar. Yes. You know, many of those wind farms you see in the Pacheco Pass, they may be spinning, but they're not doing anything useful because they're just not even hooked up sometimes. There's rules and regulations to generate the capacity, but not to actually make use of it. And so part of the problem with some renewables is the time shifting. You know, you have different needs at different times, and especially wind often is a nighttime peak, and you usually have daytime needs. So storage is needed throughout. They can pump water. There's all kinds of things at the grid you can do when you do have one big centralized plant or put something near a power plant. But I guess it goes back to an investment we had a long time ago in demand response. We realized that there's a lot of inefficiency in the utilities where they'll build entire gas-fired power plants called peaking power plants that are just turned on for a few hours a year at most for those peak needs. And it's like all that infrastructure, just because you couldn't do needs sharing or have a capacitive buffer, if you will, like a big old battery sitting in there on the grid, you wouldn't need that. And so distributing that just makes it so much easier, putting it near the point of consumption and point of generation in a solar context.
But what is the market for these utility-scale batteries? Would it be companies like Apple that are going solar in a big way, or is it to sell to PG&E?
In general, there's a whole cascade of markets, everything from consumer for their home, businesses, and the utilities themselves. The utilities can go to all kinds of technologies, and so even telcos, like for a cell phone tower, you need storage there as well, especially in places like India and elsewhere. And so they have everything from, there's technologies like flow cell batteries, there are compressed air solutions being developed, there's a variety of different ways you can do approaches to this in general. Tesla's approach is just leveraging what they know best, which is the lithium-ion cell chemistries and batteries, and putting them into in a battery management system so that you can potentially address a whole range of these.
So it's the same batteries they use in their car?
Exactly.
Got it.
Yeah,
got
just
it.
Thousands of them. Right?
Okay, so we've got a lot to get through here. I want to jump on to deep learning. What is it and why is it important? And you're an investor in D-Wave Computing. Can you connect the two?
Sure.
Are they connected?
They are, and Nirvana also is a direct investment. They're making chips to accelerate deep learning. So deep learning is a nice phrase that makes it sound new and different versus neural networks, which is what we called them in the 80s. But it's basically the same thing, gussied up, of course, with a lot more compute power and some algorithmic advances. But basically what this is a way of programming a computer to learn something. It's a generalized, domain-independent learning machine, kind of like our brain. We could learn any language. We could speak any language. We chose to somehow in life we know the things we do and we speak the languages we speak, but we have a generic brain, right? Deep learning is somewhat that was a cool song. Deep learning is somewhat analogous in that it's a capacity to learn where you have a set of inputs, could be handwritten characters, and a set of outputs, what were those characters, to let's recognize handwriting or you know, the writing of the signature on a check. Once you train these algorithms or build them, you realize they can do just about anything that we consider pattern matching or consider almost human-like kind of intelligence. So Google uses these techniques throughout almost everything new that they're doing, right, in ad matching and in search. It's sort of it's that thing I was alluding to earlier that allows you to design things that exceed human understanding. And when you build the capacity to do this, let's say in robotics, you can apply it to search. You can apply it to image recognition. It's a very fungible capability. And I think it is the path eventually to AI. So the reason I think it's interesting is right now the tech companies, the Baidus, Facebooks, Microsoft, and Google are some of the leaders. They have a lot of the engineers and a lot of the capacity, and it's riddled throughout all their products. And I think they realize, whoa, we can point this capability at industry after industry after industry and revolutionize it. And I think that's what they're going to do. So we invested in one of the spin-outs of Google. It's going to apply it to the construction and building industry, sort of like architecture and building construction.
What's the name of that company?
It's called Flux up in San Francisco. This is the first Google X, only Google X spin-out. And then Google's applying it to robots and everything else that they do. And I think eventually, though, every company is going to use it, right? From agriculture to finance to you name it. You asked about D-Wave. D-Wave is a really far-looking company. It's a quantum computer company, which computes in an entirely different way. And they are selling, have sold two, and about to sell several more of these computers to Google to use it for machine learning and deep learning, of course. And Google already has said that it outperforms anything in their data center. And this could be an incredible leap forward for this whole technique of how do you Particularly what makes big data interesting. Everyone would say big data is a big headache if you didn't have techniques like this to sift through and find interesting patterns in big data. Is another way of thinking about it. And with a quantum computer, if everything goes according to scale, it will, like in the next 10 years, be unparalleled, where the only explanation for how they work is the engagement of parallel universes, and that makes it really hard to compete if you're just in this one. So it's kind of a frame-breaking approach to computing.
I read a prediction. Mm-hmm. They said that quantum processors will be in our laptops in 10 years. Do you think that that is realistic?
Mm-mm. No, because I don't think we'll put them in laptops. I think we'll just tap them from our laptops in a cloud service, because they have to be cool to, like, less than 50 millikelvin, which is colder than anywhere in the natural universe.
But you think they'll be accessible from our laptops?
Oh, yeah, they already are for certain folks at University of Southern California and Google and NASA Ames, and Lockheed Martin. Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the end result of, robots and deep learning, there's been talk, Elon Musk for one, Stephen Hawking, the robo-apocalypse. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, in all of our science fiction and in our fears of the future, we imagine creatures, beings, robots, AIs, whatever, that are vastly more capable than ourselves competing with us. And that feels kind of scary. They would take our lives, take our jobs, take our resources, eat our corn. I mean, like, kind of silly if you think about it. But if you instead shift that thinking to, would you want your great-grandchild to be smarter and healthier than you? Be like, oh, of course. That's not competition. That's giving rise to something better than myself. And I think our selfish sense of supremacy, that we're like the end point of evolution, can shift to almost a symbolic search for immortality in what we create and the artifacts of our creation. So that may be either the setup for a sci-fi horror thing that some engineer thinks that he's doing good by creating super intelligent beings. But I think, and they won't be controllable. So I think the idea that this is something you put safety nets around and you like have a kill switch and keep it in a box, it's going to be like Jurassic Park, right? Life will find a way is the better metaphor. And so instead we have to co-evolve with these technologies and say, our pets have a really good life. Our cats and dogs are much happier when humans showed up, right? And similarly, we'll make good pets, right? These AIs of the future are going to engage us to build the fusion reactors that feed them, right? They don't want our corn. They want BTUs, right? And if they can help us design a fusion reactor, it's for all of our betterment. Ideally, we won't even know we're being manipulated, right? We'll be blissfully moving along in our social online worlds and immersive VR rigs and doing whatever the hell we do. And we'll see these shimmering patterns of beauty around us, much the way an ant must feel as part of a hive. It's like, what are we doing now? We're building a bridge? Why are we doing this? And it'll be great.
So you are a raging optimist.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, violence has decreased in every epoch you can measure it. Why would a more intelligent being suddenly revert that trend?
Well, I hope your optimism is well placed. Mm-hmm. So talking about eating, you made a prediction, the Wall Street Journal, 20 years from now, we'll no longer be debating the inevitability of synthetic meat. We'll have steak and bacon, and it will not come from animals.
That's right.
Can you explain that?
This just seems so obvious to me. Like, when you look into how we produce meat today, it's kind of barbaric. There hasn't been a lot of innovation. There's still some animal getting its neck cut, right? And being bled out. I love bacon, so I'm not a vegetarian. I just had a big chicken burrito before walking in here, so believe me, I'm not preaching from some moral thing. But when you look at a third of all arable land being used for this, the majority of water resources, the majority of greenhouse gas production. So here's a thought experiment. If you could snap your fingers and end all petrochemical reliance, no more oil, no more coal, or you could get rid of livestock for meat. You'd have more impact on global warming by getting rid of livestock for meat, right? And that's something we could all do, but we're not going to. I'm not going to start eating bacon because on the margin, that's just a little bit of bacon, right? But the moment I can't tell the difference, the moment that steak, that piece of bacon is indistinguishable to me, I know that I will choose that. And I know my morality will expand. I will look back on my present self as being less moral than it should be. And I don't know that I can think of any other case where you can look to your future self and know that you'll condemn your present self, right? You can always look in the past and it's like, oh my God, 2,000 years ago? Really? People thought that was okay? I'm better, right? But I know this will be one of those areas where I think we continually expand our circle of empathy over the long arc of human history, from tribal to global to multi-species kind of sense of caring. I think we're right now in the epoch of being global entrepreneurs, and in the future I think we'll be, in a sense, thinking even beyond our own selves, because we'll have, maybe because we'll see something smarter than us, and we realize maybe we should have a framework that doesn't just mean it's humans over everything else.
Right. And going back to biotech, talk about alternatives to antibiotics. You posted something recently about phages, viruses that attack bacteria. Tell us about that and the potential future there.
They're really cool. Phages are these, they look like they're out of science fiction. They're these like the dodecahedrons with like a little spiral collar and these landing legs that look like a lunar lander, and they inject a bolus of DNA into bacteria to kill them, and they're incredibly effective. About half of all bacteria on Earth die every 48 hours because of these little puppies. So you know, there's more bacteria biomass than anything else, right? There's like by far the majority of life on Earth by weight is the archaea and the bacteria, and half of that entire thing is killed every 48 hours by these little viruses. So we can print them now, kind of like a 3D printer. You can design them from scratch. You can build them with no animals involved, if you will. And there was research in, back in Eastern Europe and Russia for a while on this, and before there was a lot of understanding, sort of random, like let's use naturally occurring ones. But they're exquisitely tuned. Every bacteria has a phage that kills it, and they're in a constant evolutionary dance with each other, of course, hence this rapid kill rate. But you could, in response to just about any bacterial infection or what have you, design and print locally a solution. You know, what is the bacteria? Okay, let me create a phage that kills it. And there are some gotchas because they're so effective killing bacteria that you actually can create the shock where, you know, rupturing all those bacterial cell bodies can cause harm to the host. But that aside, there are certain areas like in burn infections and such where you might be able to just do it locally and have some initial applications. So that is an example of and that's coming out of Synthetic Genomics, a company run by Craig Venter, an example of this whole new field of synthetic biology where you can print to life, where you come from a computer file to a living organism, in that case a virus, but we've also, and they'll soon have a new paper of completely synthetic life form with its DNA, does not exist on Earth. There's no animal with less DNA than this. It's the tiniest. It's smaller than anything that naturally occurs, you know, on the planet, and it reproduces, creates trillions of offspring, and the software creates its own hardware, and then you layer in cassettes to make things, chemicals, whatever you might want, and you make a biological manufacturing factory from this process, and you can do it in a distributed way, much like a printer. So you could print vaccines locally. There's a program already, they did this with H7N9 vaccine, they printed it from this process much more quickly than going through eggs and normal methods that we currently use, And by the way, you could also do all kinds of weird things between planets. Like just think of how far this can go. Like if we ever found something on Mars that was interesting, you could sequence it on Mars, send the data to Earth, and instantiate it as a living organism on Earth to study it, even if it was dead on Mars. And that would be a lot cheaper than sending the physical stuff back.
That does sound like a brave new world.
Yeah.
Talking of synthetic genomics, I mean, have they actually pivoted to this new sector? Because didn't they start off as renewable fuels, biofuels?
Right.
Is that dead now?
No. That most companies wouldn't be able to withstand more than one project, but SGI is kind of unique. They have like several going at the same time. And there was at the peak, I think $600 million joint venture with ExxonMobil. Mm-hmm. But we kind of suspected all along that was just a marketing ploy, even though there's a lot of money from them, just to say they're doing something when there was a carbon tax initiative going through government. And then as soon as that carbon tax kind of didn't seem to be real anymore, you know, but they spent most of their money on two-page ads in The Economist about their efforts, ExxonMobil, than actually caring.
So it was a bit of a greenwashing campaign.
Of course. I mean, you think they're going to do anything to jeopardize pumping oil out of the ground? That's what they do. Like, we knew that. We were dumb. We were like, we made sure the deal just gave us the money and whatever.
So they did give the full amount.
Not the full. No, they gave the deal was half for us, half for their, you know, silliness, marketing spend and stuff. But we canceled the project partway through, the company did. But we did another project with British Petroleum that was more promising. But in the process, we learned how to make better algae. And I say we, it's synthetic genomics. I just speak so naturally as if I'm there, but I'm just an investor and board member, to be fair. But so what they've done is pretty amazing. They've re-engineered algae to be like 20% more efficient in photosynthesis, which is kind of a big deal when you think about the evolutionary arc of that organism, trying to harvest as much energy from the sun as it can. But they've never optimized an industrial application of not just what one organism wants, but how about the whole ecosystem so the light can go farther down, more of them can get more light in a pond instead of one for all. It's kind of like all for one. And you get much better yield this way by, interestingly, making them more transparent. So they've done that ostensibly for the fuels program, but then you just turn and apply it to food because most of the Like all the omega-3 oils we get in our fish and seafood come from the algae they eat. The color of salmon, the color of a flamingo, the color of shrimp come from the algae they eat, the carotenoids, and all those important vitamins and nutrients. The original source of the algae, and it is so much more, like some cases 20,000 times more effective to grow the algae to get the protein or vitamin that you want.
So you feel there's still potential there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so not fuels. Anything you burn, like your customer says, give me something, I'm going to throw it in a fire, right? That's like probably not a high profit margin business, whereas if it's like a pharmaceutical, that's the other end of the spectrum, and you have all kinds of interesting profit margins, then like specialty chemicals and nutraceuticals and food is kind of in the middle. Okay. And industrial chemicals are a little bit closer to the fuels. So we do those too.
Okay. And talk about fuels. You're an investor in Solar City. Mm-hmm. Talk about the future of solar. Ray Kurzweil has, made some very ambitious predictions. Do you agree with him?
Which one of those? I know Elon says it'll all be solar.
Yeah. Ray Kurzweil is talking about the singularity and, exponential growth of solar. Do you think
his singularity is we reconstitute Jupiter into this huge Dyson sphere around the sun, the harvest 100% of its energy. Why let it go away, like capture all of it in this enormous sphere that's nano-engineered? But that's kind of far out there, and I don't really count on that one happening anytime soon. But, I mean, joking aside, there is an argument that a lot of smart people have made that solar is the ultimate endpoint that makes the most sense. I think there's a really – this is one case where looking out, let's say, 50 or 500 years maybe – I think that might blind us to some really important things we need to do on some other trajectories sooner, like – China probably could not deploy nuclear fast enough, and the major setbacks of Germany elsewhere on nuclear in the near term are devastating compared to we just can't deploy the solar fast enough today to allow that to be the 100% solution today. So even though we have no investment in anything nuclear, I wonder if it's wise to bet everything on just one.
So you feel there?
I think we should have a diverse mix. Yeah.
So you said that China can't put a nuclear
The climate change battleground is China, and they, even though they're trying to commission a nuclear power plant every few weeks, it's just not fast enough. It's like they're still building coal, and that's just the coal nuclear mix there is scary. They should be doing a lot less coal.
What do you think is slowing them up as far as
that's regulatory, even in China?
Even in China,
yeah. And the global regulatory headache that there's so many new nuclear technologies that are nothing like what scared us in the past. Ones that, for example, use nuclear waste as their fuel source, and just burn for like a log for 60 years and don't involve the transport of any material. And at the end, I just go on and on. It's not directly something we invest in, but the fear of nuclear, according to the World Health Organization, has killed more people than nuclear energy itself. Same for GMOs. The discussion, the human debate of GMOs has killed more people than GMOs, with over 2 trillion meals served. That's got to sink in at some point. Like, what the heck, right? Yet, it's held, nuclear's held on like this entirely, and same with GMOs, entirely different playing field on risk-reward. It's like, what other technology do we hold to that kind of a standard?
Right. Would you invest in a nuclear?
I would, for this regulatory headache, which is everywhere in the world. It just makes it not cost-effective to deploy new nuclear technologies compared to what it should be. It doesn't mean it can't be done, and I applaud the entrepreneurs who are doing it anyway, but it's a daunting barrier.
Okay. And talking of the World Economic Forum ranked water crisis the number one global concern this year after nuclear war and global pandemics.
Wait, after nuclear war?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, number one global concern.
What do you mean after nuclear war?
Yeah.
I would bump it ahead in
the ranking. Yeah. So we're here in California. Mm. We have a historic drought. Talk about water solutions as you see them. You're a big picture thinker. About how what you see as the solutions and what entrepreneurs perhaps here tonight or listening at home, encourage them in this area. Mm-hmm. Where do the solutions lie?
Well, that's a great question. If I could do anything, it would be a call to arms to say, entrepreneurs everywhere, please rise up. And if you have any love for the planet you live on, think of a solution here or pointing your life towards it. Because I don't know of any bigger disconnect between a screaming global need that's only going to get worse and a lack of fundamental innovation. If you look at how we purify water, the list of solutions is not that long and it's not that diverse. And it hasn't changed much. You got your distillation processes, boil it. You've got your reverse osmosis, push it through a filter. And then there's some other. We have invested in some other ones, but not many people know of others, and there aren't that many that are deployed. And that's kind of sad. If you look at, let's say, solar, broadly defined, how do we harvest energy from the sun? Oh, my gosh. There are hundreds of different approaches. First, you got solar thermal, photovoltaics, other things that involve, you know, heat or what have you, or growing things by using the sun. These are all forms of harvesting energy from the sun. And then within photovoltaics, there's many different types. There's like subcategories of categories. You know, water is like a slightly better reverse osmosis membrane. So the ones we have invested in are microbial fuel cells, basically in training bacteria to eat municipal waste and produce electricity in the process and purify the water and sequester heavy metals. Forward osmosis, where you use the physics in your favor, where you create a salty draw solution with ammonia salts that looks saltier than even seawater. And then any membrane you have, osmosis will naturally work that the seawater will push its fresh water across the membrane to the even saltier thing to try to bring it to equilibrium. But those salts are specially designed. They boil off at a temperature lower than the boiling point of water. So you don't have to boil the water. You just heat the water. The ammonium salts go off. You have perfectly pure water. And you haven't used any energy in the actual filtering, only in the boiling off of the ammonium salts, which you then reuse. That's Oasis Water out of Yale, and they're deploying a bunch of desalination solutions using that. So those are a couple that we've invested in. But we also try to intercept earlier with things like WaterSmart, which is encouraging people just through social pressure and hints that, like, hey, your neighbors are using less water per whatever metric than you are. Did you know you could do so too? And they can generate like instantaneous savings about 5% of water use. It's only 5%, but it helps in consumer homes and small businesses. Then longer term, though, I guess the problem really is, you know, are there things no one's thought of? Ways to purify water that just haven't thought of. It might relate to something biological. I'm suspecting something that maybe it comes out of a field of regenerative medicine or something where people are thinking about membranes that do certain things, and now those membranes could be deployed organically to, you know, using sun energy light to purify water in remote areas. And then everywhere else that uses a physics approach to the problem, it really becomes an energy challenge. Like anywhere else in the world other than places where you don't have any energy and you want to do it directly from the sun, if you could have cheaper energy, you could have cheaper water purification. And that might ultimately turn back to, well, could we get to better, you know, really efficient generation sources, be it fusion or maybe new forms of fission.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So we're going to get to your questions very soon, people in the audience. But I do want to talk about space. SpaceX in particular. Elon Musk told me, I want to die on Mars, just not on landing.
An impact, yeah.
tell me about your ambition with SpaceX. Why are you involved in SpaceX, and do you have an ambition to die on Mars?
No. I could get to life extension, but that's a whole nother dream. My space dream is actually to go in orbit around the moon and do a sort of spacewalk, you know, in the spacesuit, because there's no atmosphere. You can go in really low orbit and just shoot through the canyons. I mean, you skim just a few thousand feet, let's say, over the highest peaks, and no one's been in orbit. And no one's done a spacewalk around the moon. And a lot less energy in landing. You see a lot more sites. It's be kind of cool. That's my dream. And that'll be cheap and affordable and not too distant future, which is kind of interesting. Everyone who at least... if you don't kill yourself in an auto accident or something foolish in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll see that the cost of access to space is getting to the point where it should cost less to fly, let's say, pick a number of people, 7 people, 100 people, any number, around the Earth in a rocket than to fly a jet of that size around the Earth. And not for short hops, but for, you know, it's like if you threw away a rocket after every one-way flight, you know, only weirdos, governments, and billionaires would fly airplanes, and that's pretty much rocketry today. And when you make it reusable, it's more like aerospace.
So how close are we sticking that landing?
20-something. Probably 2030 for humans.
2030 for humans and
Mars.
To Mars.
Yeah.
And what about sticking that landing, the reusable?
Oh, yeah, that one. Yeah, so what she's referring to is this incredible booster return right now onto an autonomous drone ship, but eventually back to the launch pad area from which it landed.
And there was an attempt last week.
Exactly. And glorious video online. I'm glad it finally became public. So when I saw it just privately, I'm like, wow, this is really cool looking. And it looks dramatic. It looks like a big explosion. Just think of it as a poof of fire, because there's so little fuel left in that rocket when it comes back down. And so little material exploding that it actually didn't really do any damage to the ship, even though it looks like it was engulfed in a fireball. But failure aside, what's astounding is that you can launch this thing supersonic, turn it around, fire the engines back towards the launch pad, turn it around, fire them, land it like you'd expect to land in a comic book, you know, on your landing legs, right? And to actually hit on this boat that's sort of in the sea, even more astounding. And there was a small technical thing that made it fall over this time. They think they've identified it. And I'm confident they're gonna land it just like they have in Texas over and over again with a test vehicle. And once they do that, it's sort of a major, like, you know, order of 10x again cost advantage yet again.
So do you see that happening this year?
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's like we get to hear all this stuff. And I pinch myself because as a technologist, these are the people who are, you know, forging the future. They're exploring the frontiers of the unknown in science and engineering. They're literally pushing the ball of humanity forward in almost every direction that progress is occurring. And they tell you their secrets. So I also go to conferences. So I hear from them, but then like, well, how do you pick, right? So what I try to do is pick industries to say, well, who do I want to hear from? If everyone's smart and everyone's doing something interesting, I can't hear them all. Like, where do I think, let's say Moore's Law is just at that point where trial and error science is becoming simulation science, where it's ripe for revolution by software. Basically, take an industry, be it robots, drones, satellites, cars, that used to be thought of as industrial and now are software-centric. The phone was a recent, you know, of course, transition. Because once it becomes that, the new entrants take over and all the big companies pretty much die. And that's what we like to invest in. So that's going to happen to all industries. Every industry will become an information business. And we just got to figure out the sequence of which ones. So it's basically picking the sectors, listening to the entrepreneurs, and then going to the occasional conference or brain spa, I call it, where you have all these diverse backgrounds and you look for the interdisciplinary ideas, the things that fall in the interstices of good understood thoughts and are the cross-pollination of formerly non-crossed ideas.
So you're going after the entrepreneurs as opposed to the entrepreneurs pitching you. How does that work? How many pitches do you get a week, and how many of them do you actually take time to
meet?
I used
to get a lot more. I mean, God, in the dot-com boom, it was staggering how many we got. And now I'm a bit more selective in which ones, in which sectors I go. But to your first point, I'm picking a sector of interest and trying to be almost like a beacon or a magnet for those entrepreneurs by blogging or announcing or saying, hey, I'm really looking for deep learning or synthetic biology or synthetic meat. And then they tend to find us because at the very earliest days, it's hard to find them. They don't have a presence in many cases or a website. At this stage, we're trying to find them, or it's just a dream, right? Or they're just proverbially in the garage. And so I think it's more effective at the earliest stages of venture capital to announce your areas of passion and have entrepreneurs find you than to go hunting around. Although, you know, sometimes we hunt around too.
And for an entrepreneur sitting in the audience tonight or perhaps listening at home to this podcast, if they've got this hot idea, how would you advise them?
I advise them to connect with a venture capitalist or to run
Or the next step.
Is it funding? Is that what I'm talking about? Because there's a lot, like, the best step might be get a good customer and, like, forget the VCs. I mean, so that'd be, there's a whole series of advice that doesn't involve venture capital.
Yeah, but a scalable,
But if they want to get funding from a partner that can help in the venture communities, like, I think it's finding the person, not just the company, but the person that seems to have a vision match where they think that investor could probably, you know, sitting at a bar, be as excited and could pitch what I'm doing as well as anyone else, right? They could be my head of marketing or something. Because if the investor has that infectious enthusiasm the same way the entrepreneur does, that's going to help, right? Because they're just going to get it in all kinds of contexts, you know, making introductions to customers or employees or whatever. And chances are they'll stick with you if you have setbacks. Like, you know, Tesla and SpaceX have a lot of setbacks, right? I think we invested after they had nothing but rockets that exploded, right? Three in a row, and then that's when we decided good time to invest.
And was it a gut feeling that time to invest?
Yeah. It was the first opportunity we had, to be fair. We didn't get a chance. Elon put the first $100 million in, which is a really unusual way to start a company, to just solo fund it that much. And so the opportunity didn't present itself any earlier.
All right. Yeah. Another audience question. Do you think we're underestimating China?
Who? Who's we, Kimasabi? I don't know. And then also I'll wonder how much we should care. I do know we should care, but I always step back sometimes and wonder, like, why do we always talk about us versus them? It's like, what's good for America? Well, how about, like, what's good for humanity? Like, if something could help China become more clean and energy efficient, that helps the whole world. So I sometimes find myself thinking less, and of course, there'll be times when I shouldn't think this way, but like not being so parochial. I think there'll be some time in the future we look back and think, why were we so darn sub-optimized and suboptimal and you know, us versus them. That being said, there's a whole lot of them, and they are working very energetically on a lot of things. And I think like the DJI drone company, which most people know is a leader in consumer drones, is an interesting case in point where it's not just copy the West the way we like to, you know, sometimes denigrate or underplay what they might be able to do. And here you got sort of the leader coming out of China in a mass market consumer products goods company. It's kind of interesting. I know Bill Gates says their most productive developers are in China, which is kind of interesting. Their most creative teams are in China, which I still find odd. I don't quite know if Microsoft agrees with that, but that's what Bill Gates says. I guess, you know, there's going to be even more people coming online. I mean, there's something to think about. There'll be somewhere 3 and 4 billion people entering the global economy in the next 6 years. These are all people who aren't currently connected in any way to the global economy, but for a little bit of product purchase from P&G and Unilever in the developing world, and they're going to be on the internet with like a $29 or less smartphone equivalent going to broadband from satellite or maybe balloon, but certainly satellite in that time frame. And everybody in the world will be connected, and they aren't today. That's going to be the biggest influx of new people to a global economy we've ever seen, both in sheer numbers and as a percentage of the population of the earth. There's no precedent in history. And they're all going to have access to online education. They could all be entrepreneurs. They could all compete for programming jobs and crowdsourced labor. It's going to be wonderfully democratizing, right? It'll be like the American dream writ large. But as every industry becomes an information business, it also starts to feel like the lottery. But yeah, anyone could win, but your odds are pretty small because it's winner-take-all dynamics in every information business with network effects, and there aren't like localized versions of these businesses. They're all globally competitive. It's a pretty scary world in the future, I think, where most people won't have jobs.
And talking about that competition, mm-hmm. A lot of people in Silicon Valley here, we talk about, you know, will Silicon Valley maintain its preeminence? Do you think it will, and does it matter?
A kind of preeminence. It's hard to hold on to any given mantle. What I think Silicon Valley seems to just show time and time again is this physical concatenation of people with diverse skills, be it from bio to software to you name it, allows us to keep re-engineering new industry after new industry. And so if you ask people in Silicon Valley what are the two most innovative car companies, they'd probably say Tesla and Google. And like not even blink, right? And it kind of feels true. Innovative? Yeah, sure. But you know, and maybe you'd even add some others that are smaller and less well-known. You wouldn't think of anything that's normally considered a car company from 10 years ago, let's say. And that happens in industry after industry, right? So, like, SpaceX is just running circles around every other comparable company on the planet, right? And, yeah, they're in L.A., but still, it's like stuff that happens here with this mindset is the future, and it's increasingly future in trillion-dollar industries and in businesses that haven't faced real competition for decades. I mean, these companies have been sitting on their hands for a long time.
All right, talking of sitting on hands, talk about mm-hmm. the role of government and the dysfunction in D.C. I mean, we could probably talk all night on that, but if you can give me a succinct answer to...
If I had one.
Yes, what would you like to see more of from the government? What would you like to see less of?
Less of, yes. Yes. There we go. That's the best answer. Less of. No, it'd be great if the government could think of itself as constitution forming, like setting the playing field to be level and to empower the next generation. The future belongs to companies that don't yet exist. So like the most important company 20 years from now doesn't yet have a name. And how can we protect that company when they don't have the ability to buy political power or influence? Like, what is the framework or the constitution in place that gives us as a nation confidence that the new entrant will have a chance? You know, and someone who's completely disenfranchised today, they have no political power because they don't exist. And I think we've done a pretty good job in America over the, that's what makes us better than a lot of other places, I think, in this field. But that's kind of, in this topic, in this domain, maybe the most important. They could help with tech prizes, they could help with, you know, R&D labs and national labs, that helps. But not screwing up is probably the most important part.
Okay, getting out of the way a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds parochial, it sounds kind of like the traditional, almost libertarian Silicon Valley stance, you know, just get out of the way and let us do our business. But I almost mean like get out of the way in a enabling way, which is not give the answers, but figure out how to power the solutions. Maybe, you know, enabling more experiments, like getting rid of the FDA, for a period of time. I mean, I'll be just sort of radical for a second. Like, think about a path to say within certain domains you can make some huge mistakes in regulatory bodies within certain domains with certain constrictions to say, like, how can we fathom the number of deaths from things that weren't approved and to compare to those that may have had a mistake. And right now, all the risk-reward stuff on the regulatory side is completely out of whack. Medicare, FDA need to be completely re-engineered. And you might not be able to do that. Just like the education system, you might never fix it from within. You might have to just reinvent it from the outside. And so having a parallel track, something that's just sort of competitive with government as usual in every field of government, may be the best way.
All right. There's an audience question here about the potential for immortality. But before I ask you about that, talking of immortality, Steve Jobs, you have worked with Steve Jobs, and I'd love you to tell the story of how he vandalized your keyboard.
Oh, yeah. He is a passionate dude about product and people, and is just an incredible guy. So the story briefly was I was at business school, and I really wanted to have him come speak on campus, and it's been a long time, and I finally got him to come. And I'm always thinking about making kind of specials. I had him actually come to my house that I was renting, and he did a fireside chat for like 3 hours and sort of sitting in the lotus position. It was fascinating for the high-tech club, as we called it at the time. And at the end, he even stayed around and was talking more, and I brought up my Apple extended keyboard. It's this enormous keyboard with all the function keys and the little number pad on the side, and asked if he'd sign it. And when I flipped it over, there was Waz's signature on it already, and he sort of was struck by that. And I've since learned there was a lot of ice and tension in the relationship at that time, and Wozniak told me when he saw this final thing that he doesn't know of any physical thing the two of them ever signed. So there was a hesitation, but I had no idea why. I just instead witnessed that he turned it over and he goes, "What are all these function keys? This thing, it's like a battleship. It represents everything about Apple that I hate. Function one, do you ever use it?" No, he took out his car keys, pops it off. Function two, he popped off every key off the keyboard, back to the original Mac, because I remember the original Mac keyboard is like, God, it's got all that. It doesn't have any of those function keys. And then he literally said, "I'm changing the world one keyboard at a time." And like, he didn't laugh like he just deadpanned it. Like that was, I think he meant it actually, which is mind boggling. And then I worked with him after that at Next. He recruited me there, and his keyboard at Next, this is an Apple keyboard, the Apple symbol is just chiseled out with an ice pick.
I can imagine, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
And
he
burned.
He could just not stop talking about Apple when he was at Next.
Yes. Yeah. And jumping back to advice for entrepreneurs and building teams, you have talked about the importance of cognitive diversity in hiring teams. Mm-hmm. Can you expand on what that means specifically for women in the VC world and in the tech world? Sure. Obviously, there's been a lot in the news about that and the dearth of women in these sectors.
Yes. I don't know what the solution is, but I do appreciate the value of diversity. And not as the way I think of it is not as an affirmative action kind of step to make reparations for harm in the past. And because we try that and we do that. But I like the idea of diversity of all types, racial, gender, you pick it, because it's a proxy for cognitive diversity. So in other words, women and men at times think differently. So do folks with different socioeconomic backgrounds and different fields of study. So what if, and I believe it's strongly to be true, all of those forms of diversity, which you can see, are in fact indicative of a more important form of diversity you want, which is cognitive diversity, different ways of thinking. And there's been all kinds of studies out of Santa Fe Institute and a bunch of other places that says if you're working on basically what feels like a startup, a venture firm, a product design firm like IDEO, anywhere where you're doing what the book Wisdom of Crowds would have described as work in a field with ambiguity, where it's not like there's one obvious answer. It's a really tough problem, maybe even beyond anyone's full understanding. You're trying to push the ball forward in some creative way. Then you actually will find that diversity is more important than ability, meaning a team of five. And by the way, your team should always be 5 ± 2. Never more than 7 people on any team. No board of directors, no programming group, no. This is why small companies outperform big companies all the time. So somewhere 5 ± 2, very diverse group will outperform the same number of domain experts, which is astounding, right? And there are a lot of reasons for this, not just groupthink in the traditional sense of there's less ideas bouncing around, then the chance that you have a creative breakthrough might go down. It's that the people on the team are much less likely to challenge each other. And so on a diverse team, cognitively diverse, the members will actually self-report that they don't like it as much because they're always being challenged. It's like that person that just doesn't get it. And I always have to defend myself. But that act of having to defend yourself And it not being taken for granted means you actually make better decisions yourself, and you analytically get to a better place. So, and there's many layers of reasoning for this. So we tend to have, at least I believe at our shop, a bias towards women over men, diversity over non-diversity. Sure, if we were and saw a team of six women, we say, hey, maybe you want to get a guy on the team, you know, but just haven't seen too many of those. So it tends, unfortunately, to be the other way around, and that's why we call it a gender issues, because the diversifying element tends to be, how about a woman on the team? How about something different, right? And I think that's fantastic. I've come to appreciate that in the venture business. It took me well over 10 years, probably 15, to realize that those factors, like sculpting who's in the room, and the sculpting the pattern of communication, can be more important than the subject matter. So like for example, every venture firm might say, should we have a China strategy? Should we do early or late stage? Should we be in clean tech? Those are like product decisions. What they spend so little time correlating with their own success is, how did it work when we had a big team versus a small team? How did it work when we had more than one meeting a week? How did it work when we didn't let more than five people be in a room? You know, the way Steve Jobs was, you know, adamant about. Those actually have more impact, I think, on the trajectory of a firm than product decisions. And so leadership is more about sculpting the parameters of communication than it is actual product direction setting.
Great. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, we've reached the point. We have time for just one last question. And of course, it's a big one, which I will ask you to answer as succinctly as you can. You've talked a lot about technology and how it's driving that rich-poor divide. Do you have any solutions for that?
That's a great question, because you could wring your hands, and at first I did, and I didn't even want to talk about it when I couldn't think of anything good to come of it. Again, to simplify the argument, I think all businesses become information businesses. They all tend to be winner-take-all global businesses, so if you have all the spoils, and this is the long arc of, like, it's just going to get worse. So one question could be, well, how bad is it not to have a job when most people don't? Well, that actually describes much of humanity, right? Before... Well, frankly, when you had serfs and slaves, most people didn't have a job. Some people were serfs or slaves, the other were indentured rich. No one thought of it as a salary. Then we came out of that horrible period of time. We had an employment contract that replaced it. But imagine the robots of the future are those slaves, right? Never humans, because humans won't be cost effective for this. So you have robots doing effectively what we thought of as serfs and slave labor in the past. And again, please understand my use of those words is not to celebrate any history of the use of that concept. But in the future, just from an economic point of view, they're not going to be jobs for the majority of people. We don't need that for your economic output. It's going to be return on capital, not a return on labor. Well, how bad is that? Well, it kind of depends on the future you envision. There's one world, a utopia, where people don't need to work. You could do what you want. You could find meaningful work, just not a job. So you could and find symbolic immortality and contributions to online conversations, to things you find meaningful, to the human dialogue, to learning. There's a lot of things we could do if we didn't need to earn a salary. And then the question is, how do you distribute the spoils? And does it, you know, if you think at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, how can you make sure you have food, shelter, clothing, education, and healthcare? And I add those two. If Maslow was alive, I think he'd add healthcare and education to the bottom of the hierarchy of needs, so that you don't fear for your fair lot in this life. And like, that could be almost free in the future. Everything physical could cost a dollar a pound. All information goods should be free. And so, to your question, I, thinking about this, finally said, education, there's the MOOCs, there's a lot going on there. What about free healthcare forever? That doesn't yet exist. We need that delivered by cell phone, so that those 3 billion people coming online with nothing but a smartphone can get all the information services for healthcare that they'd ever need, and that should be free. Just like we never expect search to be paid for again, why would researching and knowing the exact thing that you need for your situation ever be something you pay for? Because there's so much money to be made in other parts of the system that should exist, and some new entrant could do this for almost no money, like $10 million, maybe 12. Launch it as a service with a deep learning harness. Everybody who uses it reports back what happened, what they tried. I took aspirin. I didn't do anything. I slept it off. I died. You know, whatever it is, you enter it. You get all this data, billions of data points. You all of a sudden will outperform the existing healthcare system, and it'll just be better. So that was the one idea. So that's sort of like addressing almost the symptom that the jobs will go away, because I think it's inevitable the jobs will go away. And I think we just need to prepare for that future, and most importantly, talk about it now so that the transition isn't violent and horrible, because no one is in that framework of like, okay, 40% unemployment, 80% unemployment. What does that feel like? Like we're going to get there, right?
Okay. So, unfortunately, we have to wrap it up. I hope you've enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. We would like to thank Steve Jorbertson for a very insightful and mostly optimistic view of the future. I would like to thank the audience here in Palo Alto and those joining on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.